This is episode 59 of the Renew the Arts podcast, Artists and the Problem of Fame. Welcome to the Renew the Arts podcast, where we discuss the role of art and creativity in the church and in the world. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. Our motto at Renew the Arts is liberate Christian creativity, and we're doing this through cultivating Christian communities in and through the arts by inspiring art patronage and supporting artists. If you'd like to join our community of monthly donors and contribute to this podcast, please visit renewthearts.org/donate. If you want to join the Porchlight Network and begin your journey into patronage, go to app.porchlight.art and sign up as a host or a tender. Thank you for joining me again today on the podcast. We are going to be talking about fame. This is part one of a two-part series on artists and art and the problem of fame. Today, we're going to focus mostly on the issues of fame with the artist, how it affects the artist and their work. But next month, we will release a podcast talking about the issues of fame and the arts more generally and patronage, particularly in the ways that it is detrimental to the patron. Let's just introduce the topic a little bit. We've talked about fame a little bit in passing on the podcast, and I'm sure that you recognize that I have a real heart for local work, and Renew the Arts is really about developing local communities and local artists and local support. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the issues of fame and how that has affected so many various different things in the arts. So first off, what is the problem of fame, especially when it comes to the arts? So let's uncover the bleak reality of the situation. And that is that only the most widely known and famous artists are able to make a living from their art. And I'm not just pulling this out of thin air. One statistic concerns the visual arts, and I'll link to these articles in my show notes if you would like to read about this more widely. But according to an article in Contemporary Art Issue, they said that 85% of the total amount of artists, these are visual artists, will struggle to make any decent amount of money, remaining unknown, undiscovered, and their works thus unsold. They are outside the art world, unable to participate in the right exhibitions or meet the right people, cannot find their way in. As a result, 45% are making $0 a year, and another 40% are making approximately between $0 and $25 a year. Only 1% are making more than $1,000 per year. If you think about this, if only 1% are making more than $1,000 per year, $1,000 per year isn't even enough to live on. If 99% of people going into the visual arts are making less than $1,000 per year, that means the vast, vast, vast majority of artists are not able to make a living. This also applies to music, as you probably know. A Rolling Stone article from 2020 relates the abysmal disparity of streaming distribution. Look at this. Per Alpha Data, the top 10% of artists take nearly all the streams. The top 160,000 artists who released music during that time period saw 99.4% of the streams. Almost half of the artists analyzed saw fewer than 100 streams. The situation with radio is actually even worse, as it says in the article. Streaming does, however, mark a notable improvement from radio, where the top 1% received practically all. Read 99.996% of radio spins on the music release during that time. It's not just the situation in the secular world. It might be even worse with Christian artists. This is from an article on worshipleaderresearch.com, and it says, from 2010 to 2020, 38 worship songs appeared on the CCLI and Praise Chart's top 25 list. 37 of them were co-written or popularized by a mere 5 megachurches. So if you look at that, there's a pretty overwhelming amount of information out there that about 1% of artists, whether music, visual artists, and this really extends across the board, but I'm picking out these two things as representative examples, like basically 1% of artists within those fields are even making what starts to look like potentially a living wage from their work, meaning 99% of the people in those fields are so unknown and so undiscovered and so obscure that no one knows anything about them and they can't make a living from their work. So you might think, clearly the situation is that if you do not already have fame, you're probably not going to make it as an artist. So why is that the case? Well, there's a lot of different reasons, but we're going to focus on a few. One is the market forces of familiarity and security. Because of the fact that the arts have largely been marketized, meaning that the arts are in a market, we've moved away from the patron system, and currently it is a market system for the arts. And so all the same things that work, the forces that work within the market, also work within the arts market. And there are a few of those. One, we tend as consumers to receive what is already familiar to us because we're resistant to strangeness and also resistant to strangers. This accounts for a wide range of social phenomena, everything from largely innocuous brand loyalty to deep-seated and malignant racism. But it's definitely the case that as human beings in general, when operating on autopilot, we tend to reject the unfamiliar and to accept what is familiar. This is some of the reason why putting out political signs with just the name of a candidate has some success. In fact, it has a large amount of success because people will say, oh, I've seen that person's name before, whereas I haven't seen this person's name. And so just that very familiarity of I've seen that person's name will sway elections. And this is, again, statistically proven. So familiarity is a major reason why things that are already well known tend to be continually reinforced because they are already familiar to us, even if it's just from being pushed in our face constantly through advertisement or because other people are liking them. And speaking of other people, we also tend to trust what has already been trusted by other people. Sort of that principle of 100 million people can't be wrong. If this many people like McDonald's, McDonald's maybe is worth trying out. I actually had a pastor argue with me that the greatest band of all time should be determined by the number of hit singles that that band had written. He apparently was under the impression this was the Bee Gees because they had written also hit songs for other people. But I actually think it's Paul McCartney, apparently, statistically, who's written the most number ones. The second most number ones is someone you've probably never even heard of. His name's Max Martin. But he's written a bunch of singles for all sorts of different artists. Anyway, all that to say, I don't think that you can determine the quality of something just based on the fact that it has been liked. Sometimes it's liked because it has been liked. You think, oh, well, if everybody likes it, then it must be worth checking out. And we all are susceptible to that, and it's not even a problem. I mean, it makes sense. If a huge number of people think that something is good, maybe it's worth checking out. So that makes sense. The third market force that plays into this is that we tend to more easily receive anything that doesn't challenge or require anything of us. In the same way that we like fast and junk food because it's easy to enjoy. We want things easy, simple, disposable, and convenient. I mean, that makes a whole lot of sense when it comes to a commodity. Art as a commodity is no different. We tend to gravitate toward things that don't challenge us, that aren't too difficult to find. I mean, that in itself, if something is already obscure, there's a level of difficulty in finding it. You know, I mean, are you just going to search through all the millions and millions of unnamed artists and figure out if you like something there? And if the algorithm's not going to feed it to you on a playlist or on random or whatnot, then how are you going to find it? How do you do that work? That's a lot of work to do. That tends to make it very difficult to find new artists if you are already enjoying or appreciating artists that you've found. And so all of these factors put together drive us to consume familiar, safe, already popular art that doesn't challenge us or require any great effort on our part. And the algorithms and markets tend to reinforce this, as we said. This is one example of what's called the Matthew effect of accumulated advantage. It's actually named after Matthew 25:29, where Jesus is quoted saying, "To him who has, more shall be given, and he shall have abundance. To him who does not have, even what he has will be taken away." A few recent studies incorporate this idea of the Matthew effect, where things that are already popular tend to be reinforced as more popular. One really interesting study was by Salganik, Dodds, and Watts. They published an article in Science in 2006 that is called An Experimental Study of Inequality and Unpredictability in an Artificial Cultural Market. Don't let the title throw you off. It's actually a really interesting study. They basically created a virtual playlisting platform called Music Lab. And they had on this platform only unknown, no-name artists that nobody in the experiment knew anything about. They then separated their test subjects into two. One of those test subjects were in what was called the independent condition, where they were given access to the playlist or to the group of artists, and they weren't told anything else. Through their own searching, they had to sample and then determine whether or not they would download songs pretty much just at random. They would look at the, you know, band name or the song title and think, oh, that might be worth checking out. They'd listen to it for a little bit. If they liked it, they'd download it. And they found that that group tended to have a pretty even distribution and was usually a pretty better assessor of quality because they had put various different kinds of qualities of songs, well-written, well-organized, well-composed songs by people who knew what they were doing, and also badly produced or badly written songs. And so they had some idea of the value, you know, the intrinsic or objective value of the work that they were putting on Music Lab. They had a totally different group of test subjects that were separated into what they called the social influence group. And with this group, they also gave them access to Music Lab. It was the same music and the same artists, but they included relative popularity and download statistics for this group so that they could actually see how many times a song had been downloaded, and it would actually rank the songs on the basis of how many times it had been downloaded. And what they found was that you had this Matthew effect, and that the social influence group immediately reflected cultural market trends more closely as far as inequality and unpredictability, because they actually separated into eight different groups of social influence groups, each of which were given the same starting parameters. What they found is that each of them would go in kind of different directions based on just what random songs happened to be most selected at the get-go. Whatever songs were most selected in the get-go tended to be reinforced over and over again and listened to over and over again, whereas the songs that didn't randomly get selected from the get-go tended to be more and more buried and forgotten as the process worked out. So what though, right? I mean, what's the problem with this? In a 2015 response article called The Benefits of Social Influence in Optimized Cultural Markets, the authors write, fewer cultural products are consumed overall, and some high-quality products may go unnoticed while lower-quality ones are oversold. So that was one of the things they said was an effect of this Matthew effect in terms of social markets or cultural markets. Fewer overall products are consumed, meaning that the variety of things that are actually received is reduced. Some high-quality cultural products go unnoticed, meaning that they're not utilized or enjoyed or have any place in the culture. And then also lower-quality products tend to be oversold. In both of these articles, it indicates that the very, very worst things didn't tend to do very well, and the very, very best things didn't tend to be overlooked entirely. But typically speaking, the social influence environment drove itself toward mediocrity over time, that basically it would promote middling things that tended to be very much overemphasized. And if you look out at the market and what it has produced in the arts, I would say it's very hard to escape the reality that we are definitely enduring the ascendancy of mediocrity in the larger cultural market.
Hey there, this is Katie Martin, President and CEO of Renew the Arts. We'll get right back to this episode in a moment, but I wanted to sneak in and say thank you for listening to the Renew the Arts podcast. If you are a regular listener and find the conversations on this podcast valuable, I want to ask you to consider making this the year you become a monthly donor. I know Michael has mentioned this opportunity previously, but as a reminder, we have a matching grant available to new monthly donors. Thanks to the commitment of one of our generous board members, any new recurring donations starting at just $10 a month will be matched 100% up to $10,000 for the rest of this year. We have quite a ways to go to take full advantage of this pledge, so please visit renewthearts.org/donate to get started. Thank you in advance for your support. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Let's talk for a little bit about why it's detrimental to artists. And in the next part of the podcast, we'll talk a little bit about why it is also detrimental to patrons and to the arts in general. And we might even talk a little bit about what can be done about it. And I want to start this section by retelling one of my favorite stories from the Bible. It's the story of Micaiah, the prophet of the Lord, and Ahab, the false king of Israel. So Ahab decides that he wants to go to battle against Ramoth Gilead, which was this stubborn city up north. And he invites his friend Jehoshaphat, who's kind of intermarried into his family. Jehoshaphat's the king of Judah. Ahab is the king of the northern tribes of Israel. And if you know anything about Ahab, he's a terrible king and kind of a terrible person and a whiner and a lame-o. Anyway, he invites Jehoshaphat up, Jehoshaphat sitting next to him, Ahab sitting there, and they are apparently inquiring of some prophets about whether or not they should go up to Ramoth Gilead. Now, all the prophets know what Ahab wants to hear. And so the head of the prophets has instructed all the other prophets, hey man, Ahab's really keen on going to Ramoth Gilead, so everybody is going to say, Ramoth Gilead, good idea, go Ahab, go defeat Ramoth Gilead. And so this particular prophet, he's got his horns, you know, and he's distributed the horns and everybody's holding their horn of power and they're thrusting in the direction of Ramoth Gilead. And they're talking about how, you know, thus and thus and thusly will Ahab do to Ramoth Gilead. And, you know, all this kind of stuff. How great, how great, how great Ahab must be. Jehoshaphat is watching this whole proceeding and he's not impressed. And so he says to Ahab, hey, Ahab, do you have any, you know, actual prophets of the Lord? And they do. And so Ahab's like, hey, there's this one guy, Micaiah, but he's a real jerk and he never says anything good about me. And of course, that just means that Micaiah is a terrible prophet and not that Ahab is a terrible person. And so he has Micaiah silenced and off on the side. Anyway, Jehoshaphat's like, well, I'll call for him. So Micaiah comes and the false prophets are all like, hey, Micaiah, you know, I don't know if you knew this, but we're all telling Ahab what he wants to hear. So maybe you should also say that too. And here's a horn if you want to sing a song or something. So Micaiah goes out there and he says, we must go up against the Ramoth Gileadites, you know, and all this other kind of stuff. He starts singing the song that the other prophets have been singing. And Ahab's like, how many times do I have to tell you to only ever tell me the truth in the Lord? And so at this point, you know, like the spotlight goes directly on Micaiah and everything goes dark. And he's like, I was in the presence of the Lord and I witnessed, and, you know, and tells the story about how Ahab is just going to totally wreck shop and things are going to go poorly for him and he's going to die and the whole kingdom is going to be shattered and all this other kind of stuff. And so Ahab, of course, is like, oh, see, I told you, Jehoshaphat, this guy never says anything nice about me. So they imprison Micaiah and go up against Ramoth Gilead. And as you know, I'm sure, despite Ahab's best attempts to try and get Jehoshaphat to be the one to be hurt, he just goes as a random soldier and disguises himself. And yet even still, God finds his man when some rando archer is walking away from the battlefield, turns around and at random, you know, just kind of shoots an arrow up in the air. It's his last arrow. He didn't want to take it home, apparently. And it hits Ahab right in the space and under his arm, you know, and he's dead. And that's the end of that story. So Micaiah was right, but what he had to say was not desirable. And, you know, I've used this story in the past because it is exemplary of the challenge that people who want to tell the truth and who want to tell it in the arts, because don't get me wrong, the prophets were artists. I mean, everything you see about the work that they do in the major and the minor prophets, it's almost all written in a poetic, lyrical form. Very often what it is also expressed in metaphor or theater. So it is very much art. These are artists, you know, the psalmists as well, and a lot of storytellers in the history of the prophetic arts. And so if you think about how very often the prophets are persecuted, it is clearly the case. Okay, it is clearly the case that their target audience very often would not support their work directly. That if they were going to be supported, they were going to have to be supported by other means, oftentimes very unconventional means, like, you know, ravens bringing the meat and the brook Kidron and things like that, or angels ministering to them. And this happened because their target audience was not going to support their work. This is very often the case. Now, if we, as a church, generally speaking, say that artists must be famous or popular or accepted in order to gain our support at all, then we're definitely going to just perpetuate this. I mean, you might look back at the Old Testament and the Israelites there and say, oh, well, they're really awful people and we're not that bad. Well, they weren't trying to be awful. They were just going with what was familiar and safe and reinforcing where they already were. I mean, Ahab just wanted somebody to tell him what he wanted to hear. He wanted to hear something safe and familiar and reassuring. If you're saying that we're significantly different than that as a culture, I don't know to tell you. It doesn't really seem like that's the case. In fact, it seems pretty obviously not the case. So how does that kind of a culture affect artists? Well, there are two different kinds of artists affected by that culture. On one hand, you have quote-unquote successful artists. And on the other hand, you have quote-unquote unsuccessful artists. So whether you're successful or unsuccessful, I think that this problem of fame affects you adversely. So let's look first at successful artists. How does this affect successful artists badly? Well, for one, since marketable art is often extremely derivative and general, actually encourages successful artists to be totally out of touch with their local or even specific realities. So their art and what they have to say about the world, there's an encouragement towards doing work that's already been done and making sure that your work is really, really, really generalized so that it doesn't exclude any potential market. And so whether it's praise and worship music that repeats the same vague, general, abstract lines over and over and over and over and over again and sounds like everything else that's ever been made, or some pop music or country song that could be spliced up into a medley with any top 40 songs that have been made in the past 10 years, and you could do it seamlessly without pretty much any distraction. So in all those cases, you know, you think about what does that actually do to the successful artist who's forced into that box? They're almost encouraged or incentivized to avoid reality, to avoid talking about reality, but also to avoid experiencing reality too deeply. And that obviously has had a really terrible effect on most successful artists, many of whom have struggled with mental health, and often there is suicide and just unhappiness in general. I mean, it's like, well, you're encouraging them to be dehumanized, to just make something that has nothing to do with anything they see or know, and has nothing to do even with their own personal reality, but is so general and so abstract and so commoditized as to be totally and completely unhuman at a certain point. I mean, that has an effect on artists that's not good. It's really terrible. And connected to that, you have this idea that once you become popular, in some sense, you're enslaved to what made you popular. You have to keep making that same record. Or if you try and do something else, people don't like it, and they push you back into your corner, and you end up in this, you know, one-hit wonder trap of people just constantly trying to chase after that one thing that was a hit and really not ever able to quite recapture it. And so you end up seeing them, you know, washed up in their 40s or 50s, still playing that same track from the 80s that everybody still somewhat likes, but it becomes more and more sad and more pathetic. And this is just a reality for successful artists, that they become enslaved to the very thing that they thought they desired more than anything else because of the structure of fame as it is. If we could just, you know, figure out some possible way of distributing money and that success and that support where, you know, rather than one artist having 27 billion streams when, you know, 99% of artists have less than 100, that would probably be good, not just for the people who have less than 100 streams, but also for the musician who has 27 billion and whose life is totally and completely overtaken to the point where these majorly famous artists, I'm sure, would really, try and like to figure out a way where they didn't have to be quite so famous. You know, you have like situations where Daft Punk, the French electronica duo, they actually wore masks every time they went out in public, and they had these sort of robot masks and this robot personas. And they did this so that they could have private lives that were unaffected by their professional lives. And I always thought that was kind of interesting and maybe even pretty smart as a way of avoiding having the fame totally and utterly consume your reality, your private reality, and make you into something in general that you are really only wanting to be on stage. So that's some of the effects on successful artists. You don't really have to look very far to find that famous artists have had a really difficult lives. I mean, in one sense, it's not difficult. They make lots of money. Everybody knows their name. Everybody loves their work, kind of. But on the other hand, their entire lives are overrun. They have no real connection to reality, and they become as much a commodity as the things that they're making, as lacking in personal character and personal distinction as the work that they're producing. They themselves become the product and become the brand. And that is not a pleasant reality for them either, and it isn't terribly helpful to them. As far as unsuccessful artists, of course, that affects the vast majority of artists. That would be like 99% of artists. They lack support, which, you know, makes a difference if you can't actually do what God's called you to do and get support to do it. And you actually can't even get support until you don't need it. People aren't listening to your work until they're already listening to your work. Your church doesn't care that you exist as an artist until you sell a few, you know, million records or whatnot. And then all of a sudden they're trying to get you to come in and become a spokesperson for their group. And they're talking about how, you know, this really important famous artist came from here, you know, and all of a sudden they care. And they didn't even care. And they didn't support you until you didn't really need it anymore. That's the terrible situation for unsuccessful artists as well. Not only that, you're tempted constantly to make something that maybe isn't true to what you should be making, like Micaiah. You're tempted to go and say what everybody has agreed they're going to be saying in order to tickle the ears and confirm the biases of particular audiences. What if that's not what you've been given to say? What if that's not the truth? What if that has no connection whatsoever to your individual perception or reality? You're tempted constantly to throw all that other stuff out and become something that you're not, so that maybe potentially you can make a living as an artist. And you're also, and this is the other part of it, tempted to devalue local favor and local ministry in order to pursue this virtual or centralized success. Think about what that means. It's kind of like, you know, you make music for a particular church or for a particular community, and the people in your community really love what you're doing. But it's not enough. It's not going to do it for you, because you really need to get that centralized fame or you're not even going to be able to make a living. And so there's these temptations constantly for unsuccessful artists, because of the partiality of the market, to draw them into what turns out to be a really dehumanizing and derivative and abstracted market, just so that they themselves can become a commodity. And they tend to devalue their local communities because of that, and oftentimes are tempted to devalue the work that God has given for them particularly. So this is a really big overall problem, and I recognize I'm barely even touching on it as much as it deserves. But I would like to spend a little bit more time in the next part talking a little bit more about the ways that this same issue affects patrons, and then also talking maybe a little bit about how we can fix this. This may seem like a depressing, insurmountable issue. If you're an artist out there, you might be listening to this and saying, how are we ever going to be able to overcome this? And if you're a patron or a listener, you might feel a little scolded or a little bit, you know, like I'm giving you a hard time. And that's not really what I'm trying to do here. This is an issue that does need to be addressed, I believe, for the sake of artists and for the sake of the arts and for the sake of the church, because I believe that ultimately one of the major issues here is that we never should have allowed the market to be the driving force behind the arts. The arts really shouldn't be subject to market forces. It is not helpful. I actually think very few things should be ultimately subject to market forces, aside from commodities themselves, and pretty much only commodities. And even those, there should be some care and consideration in there, some spiritual value and significance given to those works. Those too should not be totally dehumanized. But that's probably a topic for another podcast. For now, thank you so much for listening. And I pray that this podcast does help you, and the next one as well, to invest in the local community and the local art scene. And if you need to know some ways that you can do that, I hope to be able to cover some of that next podcast. But you know, you can always check out all of our other podcasts and always send me a message or comment if you want to. And I will do my very best to respond if you have any issues, questions, etc. All right. Well, we will see you next time. For now, I wanted to leave you with a track by a porch light artist, Trayland Eltroth, called I've Found Love in Mississippi from his recent record For My Friends and Family. Traylon has a wonderful spirit of hospitality, and his emphasis and investment in his local community really shines through in this song. If you want to catch Traylon live, check him out at app.porchlight.art and see if you can't attend one of his shows or even host him through the Porchlight Network. Anyway, here is I've Found Love in Mississippi from Traylon Eltroth.
Sometime in August, wake me up out in the garden when the heat is done. I know my neighbors, one in six doors down. They love my family like no one I've found. No matter where I go, I found love. Oh, Idaho, Chicago, I love white. West Virginia, California, you're beautiful. No matter where I go, I found love in Mississippi. Somewhere in London, two people met. They headed south from the winter storm. He was a sailor searching for home. But he found a girl, sweet like honeycomb. No matter where they go, they found love. Ohio, Chicago, I love white. West Virginia, California, they're beautiful. No matter where I go, I found love. Ohio, Chicago, I love white. West Virginia, California, the beautiful. No matter where I go, I find love in Mississippi. Sometime in April, wake me up. When the birds sing and the rain has come, I know my family, one in six streets down. They love my neighbors like no one I've found. No matter where I go, I found love. Ohio, Chicago, I love white. West Virginia, California, they're beautiful. No matter where I go, California, they're beautiful. No matter where I go,